The U.S. Department of Justice is suing a U.S. state over a new law that threatens a sacrament. Assistant U.S. Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon is here to weigh in. Pope Leo XIV continues to define his pontificate with new appointments and Jubilee year addresses. What are we learning in the early days of the Leo era? The Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal are here with analysis. Foreign policy expert Dr. Waleed Faris update us on the continuing crisis in the Middle East following U.S. airstrikes on Iran. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. The U.S. Department of Justice is going after a recent law in Washington state that would force Catholic priests to violate the seal of confession. Why are there increasing numbers of states attempting to force the church and her priests to violate the sacrality of the sacrament of reconciliation? Joining us to discuss this and much more, Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice, Harmeet Dhillon. Harmeet, so good to see you. Have
Thanks
you back
for having
on the show.
Me, Raymond.
Delighted. As Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department, you announced this lawsuit against the state of Washington this week, which would require priests, particularly priests, they're mentioned in the law, to violate any confession if they learn details about child abuse or neglect. The DOJ filed a lawsuit on June 23rd, and it argues that the Washington law violates the free exercise of religion for all Catholics. Explain the ramifications of this bill, and why did your office decide to take this up?
Well, thank you for asking. So first of all, starting with the president and then flowing down through the attorney general, religion is a top priority in protecting people of faith. I mean, this country was founded on freedom of conscience. And so it is the first in the First Amendment as well. So, and I believe very deeply in that. And so what we saw this law come across our tables, it's a Washington State Bill 5375. It has a laudable goal of protecting children from child abuse, but it singles out priests as amongst other professionals who are allowed to raise privileges. So for example, a lawyer can't be forced under this law to reveal things that are conveyed in the attorney-client privilege. Doctors cannot be forced to reveal information communicated under the patient-doctor privilege.
Right.
But they did not allow priests to be able to invoke the same privilege in this circumstance, putting every Catholic priest at risk of excommunication if they follow a man's law. But, you know, when you dig into it, it isn't just the priests who are being targeted by this law, because what we're hearing from priests in Washington state is parishioners. You know, you can imagine all kinds of backgrounds of people that may have different issues legally in their background, which they're talking to their priest about and confessing that they're in violation of the law. And now they're afraid to go to confession because they don't know or believe that even the issue is going to be limited to the child abuse issue. And so people are violating their own faith to follow this law. And that will not stand in the United States. So we've taken on this law and, you know, we feel pretty good about it.
Yeah. Well, it targets priests specifically,
yes.
Harmeet. I mean, they face 364 days in prison, a $5,000 fine. You call this anti-Catholic. Why are we seeing a number of other states? They already have this on the books in similar fashion. New Hampshire, North Carolina, Oklahoma, West Virginia, Texas of all places. Why is breaking open a sacrament, a Catholic sacrament, the target of these legislators in states across the country?
Well, look, I mean, I think, again, the goal is laudable of protecting children, but this law is, I think, the only one of these that you just mentioned that singles out priests and treats priests differently, first of all. And second of all, the older laws that you mentioned, all these others, have been on the books for a long time, and no one's prosecuted priests for not for refusing to disclose this information.
So this is the first one that actually targets and distinguishes priests as someone that has to report or face these fines.
And so, you know, it's the death penalty for a priest's career, if you will, if they follow this law. And And it puts every Catholic at risk of being adverse to the law. And so, the government has many other ways of getting this information. And so the strictest scrutiny is applied to laws that burden religious exercise in our country. And this is one of those laws.
I love that your department has taken up an array of cases. And I want to get into some of the other cases that perhaps have escaped coverage and they should be focused on. There's another case in Washington State, a vaccine case that you took up.
Right.
Tell me about that and why your department decided to get involved here.
Well, this is a case where we filed an amicus brief last week in the Ninth Circuit, the notorious Ninth Circuit, where I practiced for so many years. And Coach Rolovich was fired from, who's Catholic, was fired from Washington State University for refusing to take the COVID vaccine on religious grounds. And so his lawyers are now challenging this case up to the Ninth Circuit, and the United States has taken the position that it is a violation of the First Amendment for this public institution to have fired him for exercising his faith. And it's a case of First Amendment retaliation.
You all also just took up a Title IX case against California,
right,
where you see men, biological men, competing with girls and women in sports that are supposed to be women and girls exclusive sports. What are you all saying in that case? Why did that draw your eye?
Well, there's a couple of different things happening with California. There's always a target-rich environment, if you will. But California's UC system is on the opposite side of us for discrimination on a number of different grounds. We sent a letter to all of the K-12 schools that are participants in the California Interscholastic Federation a couple of weeks ago, because you saw in the news boys taking a girl's trophy. And so we sent a letter saying, hey, this administration doesn't believe in this gender nonsense. It is two sexes, male and female. And Title IX was specifically passed to give girls and women opportunities. And that's being robbed today by this. California responded by suing me and my boss, Pam Bondi. And so we'll be seeing them in court to defend our position. But meanwhile, I think you're going to see much more action on this Title IX side in coming days and weeks.
I mean, Title IX is a federal law. I mean, it's on the books.
Title IX is a federal law, and California takes a lot of federal money, and every institution that's public in this country has to follow our laws. It's not optional for them.
I want to talk for a moment about the FACE Act. Now, that is an act that has been used for years, certainly during the Biden administration, to prosecute and jail pro-lifers at abortion clinics. Congressional Republicans are fighting to repeal the law entirely. Mm-hmm. You take a different view.
Right.
You believe there's a dimension here, the FACE Act, that's been overlooked and that might actually protect pro-lifers and protesters. Why?
Well, so it explicitly does. And so, first of all, the FACE Act on its face, if you will, protects both healthcare facilities and houses of worship. And the houses of worship part has not really been litigated much, but we're encouraging houses of worship are being firebombed, Catholic and Christian and synagogues around the United States. FACE Act is one way to prosecute those crimes.
Really?
But secondly, there are crisis pregnancy centers all over the United States where people of faith usually minister to women in crisis about their pregnancies and encourage them to keep the baby and give them other alternatives. There have been over 200 attacks that have not been punished by the law against those facilities in recent years. And the DOJ prosecuted a couple, but the vast majority that the DOJ went after were not even people blocking access, but simply praying outside an abortion clinic and invoking God's name. And so we're not doing that anymore. That business is over in the DOJ. We're not going to punish First Amendment activity. That is just purely First Amendment activity. But we are encouraging folks to come forward if they run or have visited one of these institutions. And there have been a couple of incidents, like in Palm Springs, there was a firebombing of a fertility clinic. That's a FACE Act violation. And so, you know, thank God no one was injured in that incident. It happened over a weekend. But, you know, there's also other kinds of domestic terrorism charges that can be brought there.
Wow.
But so while the FACE Act is on the books, we will use it for good.
Yeah, I love that you are looking and focusing on these cases that directly affect so many Americans. And as you said, this First Amendment right has been ignored.
It has.
Certainly over the last 4 years and maybe going back a bit further. There's a Jerusalem coffee shop case, of all things, an ironic title when you hear the marrow of this case. Why did you get involved with that?
So we heard about a coffee house in Oakland, California, where on multiple instances, visibly Jewish patrons were denied service and shouted at and spat upon. And, you know, to give some flavor of the attitude of the owners there, we cited some of the drinks and some of the decor there as well. There's an intifada beverage on the menu. There were the inverted red triangles that are, you know, virtually like a swastika to Jews in the current debate. So they can have that. They can have swastikas all over their shop, but they have to serve all comers in the United States. And this is a law that dates back to, you know, the soda fountain era, where African Americans were denied service, and we said as American citizens, we're not going to stand for that. So the same goes for Jews in America, and any person of faith has a right to walk into an open establishment and be served. So we're suing them, and you know, it's interesting that you can imagine the people who are caught up in this case have been caught up in some other things. So I think we have a lot to dig into there.
You're also defending voting rights. How is civil rights, your office, defending voting rights? I mean, I guess in this case, it has to do with illegal immigration. So we know a certain percentage of those illegal immigrants are voting in every election. And I guess this week, the DOJ filed a suit against Orange County because the California Register of Voters is accused, the local office there, rather, of hiding voter information from you all.
Right.
How is this
so
allowed?
We have we basically enforce all of the federal civil rights statutes, and voting is one of those civil rights. So one of the statutes we administer is called Help America Vote Act. Help America Vote Act gives the federal government the right to, you know, audit these papers that states are required to maintain. And every state, which is every state that runs a federal election, has to comply with our requirements. And so we asked Orange County, because we had seen a news report that there have been people who received ballots who are not citizens. Forget whether they're illegal or not. They can't vote if they're green card holders in our federal elections. And so we wanted the information to be able to verify that. We have a lot of databases that we can use to verify that. Well, Orange County gave us some of the information, but not all the information that's required by law. And so we had to sue them this week to get the information that we're entitled to so that we can make sure that all votes are counted and only citizens' votes are counted in Orange County. And so some of the pushback has been interesting, though. It has been on this illegal immigration front. And the argument being made by people in California, where California is a so-called sanctuary state, is, well, you know, what is the government going to do with that? I mean, I am just interested in on the voting front of making sure that only citizens are voting. And you now have some states. I heard an alarming report that Michigan has a law that is about to go into effect that actually will automatically register everybody. And then the burden is on the individual to take themselves off the voter rolls if they're not entitled to vote.
That's ridiculous.
It's a mockery of our federal election laws. And no other country runs their government like this. The country cannot run without some security for its laws and its borders. So we feel very strongly about this issue. And I've been doing election law, as you know, Raymond, for decades. And I was one of the president's lawyers, in fact, in the recent election cycle. So this is very important to make sure, on a bipartisan basis or nonpartisan basis, all citizens should feel confidence in the outcome of the elections. And if you don't even know who's voting or whether they're citizens, you can't have that confidence.
In private practice, you defended and represented a lot of pro-life people, religious groups, as well as people who were suffering during those COVID restrictions. And I know you represented so many of those people during the COVID shutdowns. How did all of that shape your perspective on the work you're now doing in the civil rights?
That's a great question. Throughout my entire career, I have been engaged in pro bono and then, you know, sort of virtually full time during COVID. Cases involving religious liberty, all different kinds of religious issues, but the principle is faith is very important. And what's interesting is, dating back to an opinion written by Justice Scalia, of all people, faith had been kind of demoted to a second-class right in the bundle of rights in the First Amendment for decades. And a case that my nonprofit brought, the Center for American Liberty, called Tandon versus Newsom, has now been cited by hundreds or thousands of courts. It has elevated that right back up to where it is supposed to be. And the court said in that case, the Supreme Court said, that it was illegal for California to ban people for coming together for a Bible study in Northern California during COVID. Mm-hmm. We had a bunch of other claims as well. Those did not succeed, but the faith claim succeeded at the highest level. And so now people are using that that ruling to bring all kinds of cases involving faith and putting the importance of faith right back where it should be, at the top of our bundle of rights.
Harmeet Dhillon, I'm glad you're on the case.
My
great
pleasure.
To see you.
Thanks
Thank
for
you for coming
me,
in. Some German bishops are pushing for change in the church as Pope Leo continues to reshape the Vatican through his appointments. With analysis, I'm joined by the Papal Posse editor-in-chief of the CatholicThing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. And look, the whole gang is here on set. It's practically a summer miracle. Thank you both for coming out. I want to start with something I just discussed with Assistant U.S. Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon. The government's lawsuit against the state of Washington's new law, which forces Catholic priests to divulge whatever they might hear in a confession if it touches on child abuse or child neglect. Father, Harmeet said the Washington state law is an example of anti-Catholicism. Your take on this from a canonical and legal perspective.
Yes, well, canonically, Catholic priests are bound to observe total secrecy about what they learn in confession. And that's a known tenet of our faith. That's part of canon law. Yeah. So for any government to intrude on that is therefore violating the free exercise of religion. Catholic priests will no longer be able to minister to people in the sacrament of confession when they're threatened by prosecution. So, yeah, I'm glad that the United States is taking up this case, because this is so flagrant. I can't imagine any founding father thinking that this is what they meant when they had the religious liberty clause in the Constitution.
Bob, why do you think we see these constant cases? I mean, we've seen this before, where legislators, they focus intently on cracking open the sacrality and the secrecy of confession. What's driving that?
Well, look, I think that all of these cases are driven by a basic desire for a cultural revolution in the country. The governor of the state of Washington, who is a Catholic, put this in terms that are absolutely absurd. He said, "I can't believe that my church is advocating for protecting people who abuse children." Well, that's not what this case is over. It's over protecting a church from an intrusion by the state. And you see this in the kind of unequal way in which coercion is being applied. I mean, we're being told that teachers have no responsibility to inform parents about what I regard as child abuse, which is to say when they begin to help them with transitions and very serious use of puberty blockers or surgeries. And yet our states are protecting the guidance counselors and others from having to speak about that. Yeah. But all of a sudden, Catholic priests, and by the way, Catholic priests, I don't know, maybe Father wants to comment about this. When I talk to priests about what do you do when a guy comes in and says, "I just committed murder."
Yeah.
You don't just tell them, well, you know, totals. You get
three
Hail Marys. What you do is you generally, this is at least what I hear from priests, you try to tell them, okay, why don't you go to the authorities? If you're really repentant, you go to the authorities and you talk about it. Mm-hmm. So this is intruding in the way that people are going to actually conduct spiritual counseling in the privacy of the confessional. And we know why this is. It's because they don't want the church to be independent of the state. They want control over that.
Father, I know you.
Yeah, no, Bob is absolutely right. And this cultural pattern is always against Catholicism in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, it targets the Catholic Church. Why is it that other groups aren't being prosecuted in a similar fashion? Bob is right.
Yeah. Now, I want to go to another case that drew my eye this week. Another example of government encroachment into church affairs. This time, the Canadian government has ordered a euthanasia facility to be opened and operated on the campus of St. Paul's, a Catholic hospital in Vancouver. It's now fully operational. Plans for such facilities are underway in other parts of the community. These so-called MAID facilities, medical aid in dying, where a terminally ill patient can request a prescription for life-ending drugs and then self-administer the medication if they choose. Father, how is this even permissible at a Catholic hospital?
Well, it's completely impermissible, and this is the overreaching state in Canada doing this. You know, it'd be ironic. Maybe they'll place it next to the anti-suicide counseling room for people they bring in who tried to jump off a bridge. And if it doesn't work there, then they just bring them next door. No, imagine what the Canadian government is doing. They're telling people the government fully supports your desire to kill yourself. Mm. Today it's going to be people who are sick and old. Tomorrow it's going to be anybody who shows up.
Yeah.
This is horrible.
You're depressed. Yeah. Bob, euthanasia is being legalized across the U.S. And indeed, these MAID facilities are already in some states, New Jersey, New Mexico, even here in Washington, D.C. Do you expect to see more of this, even in Catholic hospital settings?
Well, I pray to God, no. But part of the problem here, of course, is a legal problem, that once you engage the government in supporting medical, legitimate medical practices right. that are being carried out in the hospitals, well, then, of course, there are strings that come attached to this. I remember back when Obamacare was being debated, yeah. and there was a question about how abortion was going to be finessed in the mm-hmm. coverage of Obamacare. And our Catholic medical associations here in the United States, up to the highest level of the leadership, got on board with it. I think not just naively, but because they just wanted to keep the status quo the way it is. Mm-hmm. So, look, the basic problem is that we've got the ideological question of we're going to have now we're also seeing in places like England not only the euthanasia but also abortion right up to the point of being delivered. Wow. So there's death at both ends of life, and it's going to be pushed by the government even on sectarian. Medical facilities like Catholic hospitals. I think this is a horrible development.
Terrible, terrible idea. Gents, the Catholic Church continues to collapse in Germany. Two German bishops this week called for the liberalization of the church's teaching on homosexuality. Bishop Peter Kohlgraf of Mainz says the Bible has, quote, no eternal truths on homosexuality, instead urging the church to take such teachings in their contemporary context. Meanwhile, the Bishop of Dresden, Heinrich Timmerevers, says a new way of thinking is needed on the subject of homosexuality, urging a change in teaching since His Excellency does not understand which conditions the church can speak of serious sin concerning homosexuality, if at all. Father, your reaction?
First thing is both bishops should repent or resign their office because they're no longer suitable to carry out what they swore by oath when they were ordained bishops, which is uphold Catholic teaching. The notion that there is nothing in sacred scripture that contains the value of eternal truth about morality, this is ridiculous. A bishop to state that means he no longer accepts, through his statements, the duty he's been given by God, which is to guide the flock according to the truth. Yeah. This is a really bad thing. The Holy See has to stop these bishops because this is like, you know, water seeping under cement. Suddenly the whole thing's going to collapse.
Yeah. And we see Cardinal Walter Kasper, 92 years old, still stirring it up, Bob. This week he just came out in an interview where he suggested pushing the diaconate, female diaconate, and he says there is a wall between a deacon and a priest, so you can allow female diaconate with no fear of them being made priests. Your thought?
Yeah, right. Now, we know how this begins.
Yeah, this story
it starts, you know, it's a salami tactics. You move things along very slowly. Look, in both cases, what we have here is ignoring the not only scripture, but the tradition of the church. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is they're trying to say that somehow there's some modern discovery, that we know something better than 2,000 years of Catholic history. The thing that kills me the most is when they invoke the Galileo case. That, you know, we used to think that the earth went around the sun. Now we know the sun goes around the earth. Now we know that it's actually the earth that goes around the sun. Well, yeah. But the fact is, it still looks the same way, and there still is the same relationship between them. What they're trying to say is if there was some scientific study of what homosexuality is, therefore it just invalidates all the prior moral tradition. It can't possibly be that. Otherwise, people in the church, and not only about these issues, are going to have to wait for the scientists to tell us whether it's okay to believe the Catholic faith. Yeah. It's an absurdity, and not only is it an absurdity, it's an absurdity from the scientific point of view.
Mm. Yeah. Father, I want your take on this. It's a related story. Father James Martin featured former Cabinet Secretary Pete Buttigieg on his podcast this week, and he took pains to equate Buttigieg's marriage to a man with the Holy Trinity. Watch.
Now I'm in my 40s and I'm a father and I'm starting to better align with the style that is presented, the style of love and the style of concern that we associate with God the Father.
That's beautiful. I mean, it really does. It's an entree into the Trinity. How about marriage? What does marriage change your relationship with God or your understanding of God's love?
Father, your reaction.
Well, number one, Father Martin should know that Mr. Buttigieg is not married to that other man because that's impossible. If he doesn't believe that, then he too should resign as a priest because the Catholic Church teaches marriage is only between a man and a woman. So that's the first concern. Secondly, why is he encouraging him in the false notion that what he does with his partner somehow is an image of how God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit exist in the Trinity? Mortal sin is a work of the devil. When we embrace mortal sin, we reject God. This is terrible. Father Martin is leading people and confirming them in sin. This is amazing. His superiors and the Jesuits need to rein him in.
Yeah. Bob, your thoughts on this? Yeah, is this just part of we see the movement of this with the German church and then in the popular, front through America Magazine.
Look, I think this is a false identification of niceness with charity. Charity is a virtue. It's a theological virtue. It's rooted in God. It's rooted in the truth and in goodness. And instead what they're trying to say is, oh, well, it's nice. Look, you two guys, and you actually adopted two children, and Pete took paternity leave, when he was Secretary of Transportation. It's basing everything on emotion rather than on the truth of what God has established in the world. So I'm not surprised that Father Martin has done this because I think that he's been playing a double game for a long time. I'm sorry to say this about a Catholic priest, but while he claims that he's teaching the Orthodox faith, he's not telling people to violate it. Well, he has a interview with someone that by the very fact of conducting it in that way speaks volumes to people that he's actually in the other camp.
Well, this is like telling a guy who's cheating on your wife, well, look, the mistress and the wife and you, this is a new trinity you've set up. I mean, this is really blasphemous is what it is. Pope Leo addressed a group of supporters of Christians in the Middle East at the Vatican this morning. He is decrying the diabolic violence of war and people dying because of fake news. Here's the quote. But today the violence of war seems to be hitting the territories of the Middle East with a diabolical vehemence never seen before. The heart bleeds thinking of Ukraine, the tragic and inhuman situation in Gaza, and the Middle East devastated by the spread of war. We are all called, humanity, to evaluate the causes of these conflicts, to verify the real ones and try to overcome them, and to reject the spurious ones, the fruit of emotional simulations and rhetoric, unmasking them decisively. People cannot die because of fake news. It is truly sad to witness today, in many contexts, the imposition of the law of the strongest, on the basis of which one's own interests are legitimized. It is disheartening to see that the force of international law and humanitarian law no longer seem to oblige, replaced by the presumed right to force others. This is unworthy of man. It is shameful for humanity and for those responsible for nations. Bob, I'll give you first crack at this. Your immediate reaction.
Well, my first reaction is I'm surprised that he said this, because he's a man who in the past has shown himself to be a very careful speaker. Yeah. I think that this is a very incautious and maybe even irresponsible way to talk about circumstances. Look, there's fake news about Ukraine. We see all the time people claiming that Russia was provoked into this. It was the West that provoked it. I think that's absolute fake news. They invaded another country, and that is immoral. When it comes to the larger question of the Middle East, however, it's a very much more complicated circumstance. And it's not as if Israel is putting out propaganda that people are accepting. I actually think there's a large pushback against Israel because of what it's been forced to do against Hamas because of the terrible things that happened on October 7. And as for the end of that quotation, it seems that he's talking about President Trump, frankly. And it's hard to say at what point in a nuclear age you can go after someone who's developing a nuclear bomb. Usually, in when we talk about just war theory, we don't talk about preventive war. Sometimes you can have preemptive strikes against an opponent. It's hard in the nuclear situation because the stakes are so very, very high that allowing a country that is a hostile and terrorist regime to obtain a nuclear bomb is very dangerous. So you could actually argue the opposite, that for the West not to do anything with Iran would have been immoral. So,
yeah, well, and Iran has been the fomenter and the funder of Hamas, of Hezbollah, that have tortured and terrorized Christian communities throughout the Middle East, Father. We've seen it in Lebanon, Syria. What do you think the Holy Father's getting at here?
Well, I agree with Bob in his analysis. I think this is really not the most measured analysis in such a brief paragraph to try and understand what's happening here. We just had the destruction of a nuclear program by the United States and Israel developed by a terrorist regime, which is, says death to America and destroy Israel. Yeah. We had their proxies launching attacks on Israel. October 7th is now just used as a, you know, to discuss what happened. Let's see what happened. They murdered women and children. They tortured people. They still have hostages. Why don't we have a daily headline say Hamas has to release hostages because there's no right in international law to hold hostages? Mm. We don't get that. It's all about the Israelis. It always is. The Israelis did not want to start a war with Hamas. They were talking for a, you know, condominium, you know, to live together in some way. So I, saying that everybody's wrong in the same way, that's more relativism. I don't accept that.
Yeah, the fake news thing is interesting, though, that that's used. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it, what's the fake news then that we're referring? Was it the nuclear program? Or was it October 7th? What's the fake news, the provocation here? What it, or he calls the fruit of emotional simulations and rhetoric, unmasking them decisively. I don't. That's very vague.
Yeah, actually, it doesn't sound like him. It almost sounds like somebody else wrote that. He generally, in my estimation, doesn't speak in abstract terms.
No. He's usually very precise and measured. And look, one expects the Pope to urge peace. That's the role of the Holy Father. And he did that beautifully on Sunday, I thought. This address is a bit more complicated. I'll post it on X. Gents, Pope Leo XIV has a lot going on this week, from jubilee events to appointments to the episcopacy, Vatican dicasteries. Former auxiliary bishop of Melbourne, Anthony Ireland, was appointed the new Archbishop of Hobart in Tasmania. This is the second major Australian appointment in recent days after Bishop Shane McKinley was named for Brisbane last week. Bob, since we did the podcast last week, people have been asking, was Bishop McKinley in the pipeline? Did the Pope have to kind of allow this to proceed? But under either auspices, whether he did it of his own choice or he was suggested, he was the head of the dicastery of bishops anyway, so he clearly had a hand in this. It was a deliberate choice, is my point.
Well, look, some people I know put this in baseball terms, that he's batting 500. He did well in Tasmania at Hobart. He didn't do quite as well in Brisbane, as they say in Australia. But look, we tend to look at this through the lens of kind of theology and where things are headed generally in the church. Bishops' appointments, I've said this before, they sometimes can be more complicated than that. Now, we don't know whether he was on top of this or not. What he does seem to be doing, however, at this point, he's kind of going back to be more cooperative with local bishops and other officials in the church when he makes these appointments. We know that Francis tended to fly right over the head of everyone. If he had met someone from, you know, some country that he was very impressed with, suddenly they became a cardinal, for example. But I think we need to give him a little bit more time, because we're going to see some holdovers across the way. There are some people who have been saying for years that we should have had a different type of cardinal archbishop here in Washington, D.C., and I think that's probably true. I think what we have now is someone that's identified so politically with one wing of the church and of the world that it makes it a little bit more difficult for him to operate, but Leo, back then, who was the prefect of the dicastery for bishops, wasn't able to manage that because of local objections.
Yeah. Father, Leo also named a group of new voting members of the dicastery for religious, which includes four superior generals of women orders and a laywoman to lead this secular institute. This seems to carry over Pope Francis's practice of greatly expanding women's roles in the church. What's happening?
Yes, this is a very serious issue for the church because, the dicasteries were formerly called congregations, and congregations were congregations of cardinals who assisted the cardinal prefect. Now, they also included bishops and others, but it was viewed as an exercise, as you know, some kind of auxiliary way of governance that was executed through the congregation. So the Congregation of Bishops has a prefect who is a cardinal, and he proposes nominations to the Pope for bishop. So it's all about governing the church. Pope Francis said lay people can exercise the power of governments in the Roman Curia. And that's why we have a prefect of the Dicastery for Religious who is a woman, and now the second in command is also a woman. Now we have all of these
voting
women
members.
I have nothing against women. The issue is they're not ordained. The shepherds of the church are those who are made such by receiving sacred orders. And this is a very serious issue that's not going away in the church. And
is it in canon law at all?
Yes, it is in canon law. That you can't, you know, all of the congregation prefects all were cardinals. So now they're not because Pope Francis changed the law. But behind it is a canonical innovation that's supported by, among others, Cardinal Ghirlanda, Jesuit canon, has taught me. Brilliant guy, but I disagree with him on this.
Yeah.
But the notion is we're becoming more like a secular authority. Mm. You know, how many women were in Congress in the year 1900? Maybe one, I don't know if any. Yeah. Now we have a lot, which is great, but that's because the people are sovereign. They elect who they want.
Right.
In the church, the leaders of the church are those ordained.
The shepherds.
The shepherds.
Yeah. On the Feast of Corpus Christi, Pope Leo led what I think is an historic Eucharistic procession from the Lateran to the St. Mary Major, about a mile away. And he did it on foot. It was really an extraordinary, beautiful event, which we haven't seen in a long time, a pope processing with a monstrance through the streets of Rome. Bob, your thoughts, and what does this event say about the style of Pope Leo? What is he trying to communicate, do you think?
Well, I have actually been in Rome when they have their pro-life march, and I'll tell you, that too is quite something, because the Italians kind of look around, they haven't seen this before, and they look around and they say, wow, well, I guess the church is still, you know, alive and kicking.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that what we're going to see with him, it's a younger look, it's a more positive outlook. I mean, he spoke to both a group of bishops and a group of seminarians this past week, and if you read those I don't want to call them lectures, but kind of discourses that he presented. Yeah. They're very encouraging. They're very positive.
Yeah.
You get the impression that he's not scolding people because they haven't done something, or you know, trying to drive them into doing something. He's kind of saying, look, I'm on your side, but we're all on Jesus' side. And then he kind of exposes what that means.
Yeah, on the papal posse this week on Arroyo Grande, we got into the Pope's homily of Corpus Christi, and Father Jerry had some very pointed observations that I won't ruin now, worth hearing. There was also, as Bob mentioned, this celebration, a jubilee for the clergy, and religious this week. Pope Leo, he had this rather spirited conversation with seminarians. And Bob's right, there was a huge contrast. It was very uplifting, calling them to underscoring the sacrifice they're making, the important witness it is in the middle of the world. Contrast that with the scolding clericalism and rigidity talks that Pope Francis really gave all 12 years.
No, I credit Pope Leo with this positive, encouraging attitude. I mean, we have difficulty getting people into seminaries. The last thing we need is to have their formation dominated by the idea you're going to be a threat to the people of God because of the way you're so clerical.
Yeah.
That's nonsense.
Yeah.
And it was evident during last pontificate that most priests and seminaries didn't feel that was an accurate analysis.
Mm-hmm.
It's very encouraging. You know, the Eucharistic procession, that was encouraging because what do we see? The Pope himself following the way Jesus walked through the Holy Land, and he's carrying the Lord. I remember this was somebody once said, you know, you have a beautiful church, but you really want to make it very beautiful, fill it with people. And I think it's the same thing. Rome is a beautiful, eternal city. It's the city, you know, of the apostles Peter and Paul. You want to make it really beautiful, have the faithful out there, clergy and laity, processing.
Yeah. I want to get to one other thing because we're so tight on time. There is a worldwide shortage, as you mentioned, in priestly vocations. Pope Leo met with the French bishops this week, where there is a dire shortage. A glaring omission from the meeting, the vocations and ordinations within traditionalist communities. France is really one of the places where the traditional Latin Mass communities were thriving, particularly among the young. Father, what do you make of that omission? We've seen similar reactions when bishops are investigated for having too many traditional priests and seminarians. So when these seminarians are coming for tradition, they're just ignored, they're erased.
Yeah, well, this is a big problem in France and elsewhere, which is the refusal to recognize the extent of interest in the Latin Mass among laity, families, and young men who want to become priests.
Mm-hmm.
So for the French hierarchy has not understood that they need to recognize people who want to go to the Latin Mass are just as Catholic as the people who go to the new Mass. we should treat them with just as much respect.
But if it's working, if it's an attractive source of vocations, why wouldn't you shine more light on it, Bob? There seems to be an ideological presupposition here that if it's a traditional seminary and a vocation, we're just going to erase that, pretend it's not happening. That may be all that is happening.
Yeah, just this week, there was a projection done of the number of priests that in the future that are going to be in France. Yeah. And just about now, the lines are beginning to cross. The traditional priests, they're older, they're dying off, there aren't many vocations. They're dipping down, and the traditional priests are coming up. And the survey projected that by 2035, the traditional priests will be a majority. It'll be a smaller number of priests than in the past, but they will be a majority of the priests in France. So like it or not like it, either you want to just entirely drive the whole operation into the ground, or you look at what's the up-and-coming element in the church at this point. Look, if you're a young man and you're interested in becoming a priest, do you want to become a priest in a church that is basically just like the world, except, you know, we sprinkle holy water and we do incense and have some strange rites.
No, the incense. No incense.
That's right. They leave the incense, Bob.
No, but you get my point. Yeah. What you want is something, you know, you want something energetic, something you can really be committed to, that you can bring to people, that you sacrifice your life for. People want heroic, holy lives.
Yeah, they want mystery. They want mystery. But, I mean, with no disrespect meant to the guitar masses. But, gentlemen, before we run out of time, we have to address alarming incidents that occurred this week. On Sunday, June 22nd, a suicide bomber attacked an Orthodox church in Syria, first opening fire on 350 worshipers, then detonating an explosive vest. At least 25 were killed, over 60 injured. Pope Leo sent condolences to the Patriarch of Antioch. The Syrian government did ID the Islamic State as responsible. Closer to home, a man attempted to carry out a mass shooting at a Christian church in suburban Detroit, Michigan. He was eventually shot dead. Bob, what is driving this? These are Christians being targeted because of their belief.
Yeah, sad to say, this event, as you know, I just wrote a book about this, and I'm rather sensitive to it as a result. But sad to say, in Islamic areas, these things crop up, and we in the West tend to dismiss them as, well, you know, those were, they're extremists, they're, you know, they're doing this and that. No, there's a pervasive pattern of this occurring everywhere in the Middle East where ISIS or other radical groups are able to mount such attacks. Mm-hmm. In places like in Central Africa, in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, et cetera, that central belt of Africa, it's going on daily. There are probably 5,000 Christians killed every year in Nigeria. It's moved out into Asia. So, look, Islam is a militant faith. We tend to forget this. We can all try to get along. A lot of Muslims, of course, are peaceful people who just want to live, at least on a daily basis, live and let live. But it is a militaristic faith. It seeks to establish a caliphate over the whole world. It believes that when the caliphate is globalized, that is when Islam will reach its peak. And it's not a matter of conversion. It's a matter of, in some instances, conquest. And that's what you see in cases like this.
Father, last word.
Yes. No, the incidence of religious violence overseas is very troubling. In our own country, it continues to bother me to no end.
Yeah.
And this is sad, you know, that we have people who are convinced that they solve their problems by picking up a gun and killing people and go to a church. That is a diabolical aspect of this whole thing, the hatred of people who are praying to God. So we have to pray for, you know, conversion of hearts. But then sad to say, we also have to be more vigilant. And, you know, they thank God they had an armed guard at that church.
Yeah. And I guess he got a truck and ran the guy over to hold him back.
Terrible attempt.
Posse, we will leave it there. For commentary from Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, visit thecatholicthing.org. And don't miss the Prayerful Posse show dropping Friday at the Arroyo Grande Show YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, gents.
Always fun.
Thank you, Raymond.
Thank you.
And this week on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I talked to comedian, author, and podcasting trailblazer Adam Carolla for a revealing and often hilarious conversation about fatherhood, friendship, and forging your own path even when no one believes in you. Take a look.
Your twins just went off to college.
Yes.
How has that changed your life, your comedy?
Yeah, it's kind of weird, but I do have a streak of my dad in me, which is like, all right, good, I'll take care of you, but I got to go out and hit the road. I got to do shows. I got to take care of this. I got to pay these bills. And then when you come back, let's hang out.
Oh, but you're getting them internships, so you're still engaged.
Oh,
come
no,
on.
I know I'm engaged.
Yeah, you're not totally writing them off. And giving them
no. Well,
of,
hold on.
You know.
Nobody said I'm totally writing them off. I don't micro parent. You know, I'm not a
That's
helicopter
good.
Dad. You know, it's like you're grown. Yep. They want to hang out. We'll hang out. You know, my daughter came to me and said, "Can you talk to Uncle Jimmy about blah blah blah?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll do that." And then I did. Yeah. And now. That's, as we speak, that's where she is
that's happening.
Today.
Yeah, but it was her initiative and something she wanted to do.
Yeah, my son didn't ask.
Yeah, so?
So he's not doing it.
he's
working at Der Wiener Schnitzel in Van Nuys.
Well, nothing wrong with that.
I don't care at all.
Yeah, you learn. Work is never a bad lesson.
The entire Arroyo Grande interview with Adam Carolla is on YouTube at The Arroyo Grande Show, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to check it out. Subscribe. We don't want you to miss an episode.
On June 22nd, President Trump ordered U.S. airstrikes on three nuclear facilities in Iran, thus entering the conflict between Israel and Iran. How successful were those strikes? With analysis, I'm joined by foreign policy analyst, co-host of the War and Freedom podcast, Dr. Waleed Fares. Waleed, President Trump wrapped up his trip to The Hague, to the NATO conference this week. He spoke about the strikes on Iran this way.
As you know, last weekend, the United States successfully carried out a massive precision strike on Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities, and it was very, very successful. It was called obliteration. No other military on Earth could have done it, and now this incredible exercise of American strength has paved the way for peace with a historic ceasefire agreement late Monday, and we call it the 12-day war.
Waleed, the administration today, Pete Hegseth and others, said the Iran nuclear program was decimated. There have been early reports that they might have missed the targets. Now the CIA is even reporting that the nuclear targets were, quote, severely damaged. What is the real story, and is this war over?
The real story, Raymond, is that this is the first president who actually made the decision to go and destroy, at least try to destroy, this very dangerous nuclear program, which was in the hands of a jihadi regime, which has demonstrated on and on that it is against not just Israel, which they bombarded, and we saw it on TV, but most countries in the region. No president since the end of the Cold War till our president have at least tried to do something. Now, the strikes were successful because they were done by professionals and they were like surgical strikes. Some of the critics said, well, we don't see it. Well, you have a mountain, and if you don't want to see the mountain, you know what you do? You just throw a tactical nuke. This is something we can't do. So think of it as a root canal. This is the mountain. They did the surgery, got the bombs under the surface of the mountain, and blew up everything. That is, I mean, a third grader would understand that nothing would survive it. Now, I would ask another question, which is what would the regime, the Islamic regime in Iran, would do? Not about the raid. The raids were successful. It's gone. But to what extent the regime will go and try to obtain from China, from Russia, or from North Korea using the ceasefire, this time not just an aid and support to rebuild it, which is going to take 2 years at least to get there, but a tactical bomb. That's where our national security should be focusing. That's where our intelligence should be focusing. And that would be the real challenge that we will have in the future.
Waleed, will Iran come to the table and negotiate in good faith now? I mean, the Ayatollah is making more threats. You've seen that.
Look, you and I have discussed it God knows how many years, and we kind of agreed that this is an ideological regime. And as long as the ideological regime didn't dive into a deep reform, like maybe like, you know, the perestroika, the Russian perestroika, when Gorbachev said, OK, we were Marxist-Leninist. Now we're going to change. If you don't see this with the jihadist regime organization in Iran, in Syria, in anywhere, in Afghanistan, they are still on their original strategies, global jihadist strategies. So, no, I don't trust that the regime will come to the table of negotiations in the intention of going towards peace. It's too fast. But I will believe that the regime could use the tactic of going to the table of negotiations and do the same thing they've done, tried to do with President Obama, President Biden, which is to extract money, $150 billion from the Obama administration, about $20 billion, maybe more, from the Biden administration. But here they have a businessman. I mean, Trump will immediately realize if they are stalling, will immediately know. That's why he gave them 60 days. And that's why the Israelis on the 61st day actually took action. And that action, we can discuss other aspects of the action, allowed the United States to do what they've done with the nukes. And now Trump is relaxed, telling them, if you want to come to the table of negotiations, we could do business, we could go towards peace. He's going to give them the list, including the Abraham Accord, including stopping funding Hezbollah and et cetera. So he has the command of it. But what their goal is in reality is to wait 2 years for this administration to face its first test of the midterm, or 5 years until it leaves.
Waleed, based on what you know, were Iran's nuclear aspirations dashed by this action, or will more strikes be necessary? I mean, they say they can rebuild this in a matter of years. Can they?
They can, but look, who's going to help them? They've done it with, what, $500 billion, half a trillion, over 20 years. So obviously they can, demand, ask the Chinese, the Russians. The Russians are too busy with the Ukraine war. North Korea is trying to feed its own population. They're not going to go into adventures. China may. But again, I have reservation about that citation of China, because China wants to do a business deal much bigger, the mother of all deals with the president of the United States. Mm. Are they going to risk all their credibility with President Trump to go just help the regime in Iran to rebuild? They're going to be on their own. They're going to go to the private sector. Maybe if they agree with China to sell all their oil, this is a card that the Chinese will use with our president. It's going to be difficult. But regardless of who's going to help them, I just maintain again, and that's information not just from what we have here, what they have there. I mean, people inside the regime, people inside the militias of the regime. Minimum 2 years to get to those places. I mean, just imagine if you want to build a house, you have 6 months to do the foundation. That's a house. What has been destroyed is like almost the size of a city.
Well, what about the uranium? What about the enriched uranium they already had, Waleed? Where is that?
Either under the rubble, or yes, I agree, there may be a possibility that they saved a few. But uranium needs this whole construct of enrichment to get there. Yeah, they saved a little bit, but that's not going to give them the bomb. The only way is to buy it either from the black market or North Korea at this point.
On Wednesday, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, she railed against what she called the propaganda media and accused them of undercutting Trump's handling of the Iran strikes. Gabbard confirmed that new intelligence has affirmed the destruction of those key sites involved with nuclear development and enrichment. Waleed, why was the media initially downplaying the success of those strikes? We once again have the problem of intel leaks as well.
Well, you have two problems. Problem number one is the leaking coming from within the valleys inside the intelligence community. President Trump was only here for a few months. He didn't really reform. He didn't go in the intelligence community and reform it in a sense that they will be aligned with his policy. So there are quarters inside that community who are, in line with the opposition, in line with criticizing him, in line with destabilizing the administration. There are other things that they have been doing. And that's why the head of ODNI, the top of the intelligence network that we have, who is an ally of President Trump, she is admitting that basically there is an internal problem to be resolved, in my view. But also the second problem is the mainstream opposition. I mean, we know who in Washington doesn't know that the mainstream opposition is still faithful to the Obama doctrine, to the Iran deal, and maybe some of its consultants profit from the $150 billion that were transferred to the regime. So they are fighting for what they have, those interests, political, maybe 5.
Waleed, you recently wrote about Israel's strikes on Iran's jihad militias, which I found fascinating. Here's the quote. Perhaps the most significant development has been Israel's strikes on the regime's jihadi militias deployed across the country, primarily to suppress the people. This weakening of the regime's core is what truly matters. It creates an opening for the population to finally express itself. Is regime change in the offing, Waleed? And will the U.S. have a role in facilitating that, despite the president's word that he wasn't interested in that? I mean, you pointed out that the vast majority of the Iranian people want to overthrow the Khomeinist regime. And there are reports that the military has reached out to the administration. What's the actual state of things?
Okay, so first of all, the president. I know a little bit of the president. I was his first announced foreign policy advisor, so I know him, you know, from the fresher years. Mm-hmm. He can make a lot of statements. He has his own strategy to deal with the various forces that he is confronting, he's balancing with, he's maneuvering with, sending a plethora of messages all over the place. You know, in one tweet, he could say something, he reaches his goal, and in the next tweet, he surprised everybody else. So let's keep the tweets of the president to the analysis of what the president is doing. But when it comes to what he has done, he destroyed the nuclear power at this point in time. But his ally, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and Israel, being close, dealing with the future of the region and therefore with the regime, have done something, I would say, incredible. They understood the code. They understood the game. While we as Americans destroyed the nuclear system, they went ahead after that raid that we've done and started to hit the besieged militia. Besieged militias are the lowest rank of the SS, right? Mm. Those who are deployed around Tehran everywhere and have one goal, and that goal is to suppress the population. That goal is to break down any attempt for a revolution, because only a revolution from the inside, an uprising, call it whatever you want, can bring down the regime. It's not from the air. It's not from the sea. It's going to be from the houses and cities and villages. And the Israelis understood that. Had they had more, maybe 4 days, 5 days, they were very close from hitting the over 100 positions of the militias. And then the population of Iran would have actually gotten inside those positions, got the weapons, got to the police, and then threatened the regime, which explains, Raymond, and allow me this important statement here. The reason for why the regime actually ran to Qatar, there is a reason. It's not just the bombardment by the Israelis and even the collapse of the nuclear system. It's the militias that were decimated by Israel that could have provoked an uprising, and the regime would have been gone. So nobody would negotiate with the regime once it's gone.
So that is the Ayatollah challenge. Still in control is my question. There are some reports that the military has reached out to the administration, and though the Ayatollah is making threats, as he is today, is he isolated? What's the state of things now?
There are two reports that I have learned about. Number one, the report that parts of the militias and the IRGC have, and also of the classical army, Artesh, have reached out to the head of the opposition, one of the heads of the opposition, Prince Pahlavi. That's the statement that we heard from him, and that would help, making sure that the part of the armed forces are not moving against the population. But this is what I've heard. But what we heard as well, and that's even more important, is parts of the military, we don't know if it's the militia or the Artesh, that's up to the administration to say it, reached out to the administration saying that we can replace the Grand Ayatollah with another Ayatollah. It's not yet what we want. We want really an open society, elections, etc. But that's better than nothing. Now, to answer your question, already Ayatollah Khamenei was not really in control. He was the big dude and he made the speeches, but he's on the one hand too old. On the other hand, it's really the guard, the IRGC, known as Sepah Pasdaran. This is the SS of the regime. They own the banks. They own everything. They own the control even of the nuclear weapons when they were around, and they are the ones who could negotiate.
Well, we believe that they are. Waleed, thank you for your insight, as always, and your book, An Imperialist Republic and U.S. Policy, is available in bookstores everywhere and online. Waleed Farah, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.